The door opened, and a soldier entered.
"We need you, Finder," said Captain Redgar Cushebane. "There's been an attack on the Citadel cells."
The Fat Hall woke with a start and screamed. Collarin's head was pounding.
"Be quiet, please," he said, squeezing shut his eyes. "My head is splitting."
"Why is he here?"
she asked, drawing the blanket over her large breasts. Collarin smiled at the show of shyness.
"Employment, my pretty," he said. "This gentleman has come to offer me coin with which to pay for your expert services. Now go back to sleep."
Collarin continued to dress, pulling on a pair of brown leather boots over his green leggings. His shirt was of wool dyed dark green, and over this he donned a sleeveless leather jerkin lined with fleece. Moving past the captain, he descended the stairs. Two soldiers were idling there, and the innkeeper was standing by, his expression cold.
"I must apologize," said Collarin, "for the ruination of your rest, my friend. It appears there's been an emergency of some kind. I'm sure the captain will reimburse you."
"What chance of that?"
snapped the innkeeper, walking to the door and holding it open. Out in the street, Redgar started to explain, but Collarin cut him short.
"No need for words, Captain. Merely take me to the scene."
They moved swiftly through the town, up the short hill to the arched gateway where a corpse lay on the cold stone. Collarin knelt beside the body, laying his right hand just above the gaping wound in the man's neck.
"This is not where it began,"
he said, and rose to walk across the moonlit courtyard to the dungeon stairs. Here was a second corpse. Collarin paused, laid his hand on the man's head, then walked on. The soldiers and the captain trooped after him, and Collarin entered the small dungeon. On the floor was the last corpse. Collarin stood for a moment, staring down at the man. He had been castrated, and then the genitalia had been pushed into his open mouth. Kneeling beside him, Collarin touched his hand to the cold stone floor and closed his eyes. Images poured into his mind. He let them flow for a few seconds, then closed them off. Remaining where he was for a moment more, he gathered his thoughts and rose, turning to face the captain.
"What do you wish to know?"
he asked, keeping his tone neutral.
"How many were involved in the attack? Where are they now?"
"There was no attack, Captain,"
said Collarin softly.
"The raped woman lay where this man is now, pretending to be unconscious. When he too desired a piece of the vile action, she stabbed out his eyes, as you can see."
The captain did not look down.
"She used her fingers, then she took his dagger and killed him with it. She was in great pain herself at the time. But then, you know that."
Collarin turned.
"She fell to her knees and vomited there, then sat for a moment or two upon the cot."
Moving past the captain, he stepped out into the dungeon corridor.
"Still holding the dagger, she made for the stairs. The other guard was returning. He said something, but it is unclear to me. She killed him, then made her way up the stairs."
Collarin followed in her footsteps and found a smear of blood upon the stairwell wall. Touching his fingers to it, he closed his eyes once more. The captain and the soldiers were pressing in close.
"Ah, yes,"
said Collarin.
"Here," she paused for a moment. "She's thinking of three men, two soldiers, and you, Captain. She has decided to seek them out and kill them, but she is weak and bleeding. She castrates this guard too, but has little energy to spare. She is thinking of a tavern, trying to remember where it is. She has heard the men speak of spending the evening there."
"The Blue Duck?"
said one of the soldiers.
"And that's where she is heading?"
asked Redgar. Collarin nodded.
"Was heading, Captain. This was some while ago."
Redgar Cushebane pushed past the Finder and ran up the stairs, the soldiers pounding after him. Collarin followed. The four men ran through the streets, arriving at the Blue Duck Tavern, in time to see the crowd gathered around the bodies of the two soldiers. Collarin pushed through and squatted down by the bodies.
"When did this happen?"
he heard Redger demand.
"Moments ago," said a voice. "It was a woman. We saw her making off."
Collarin touched his hand to the blood on the dead Will Stamper's throat. Then he jerked and almost fell. A voice boomed into his mind.
"Delay them."
It was not a command, nor yet a plea. Collarin was surprised, but not shocked. Spirits of the dead had spoken to him before. Yet none had been as powerful as this one. For one fleeting moment, he saw a face, hawk-nosed with deep-set grey eyes, and a beard of bright silver. Then, the face faded. Collarin remained where he was for a few seconds more, gathering his thoughts. He was a hunter, a finder. His reputation was second to none, and he valued this above all else. Collarin never failed. He had trailed killers and thieves, robbers and rapists, cattle thieves and assassins. Never before had he been asked to hunt down an innocent woman, brutalized by her captors. Never before had a long-dead spirit interceded on behalf of a victim. Collarin rose and stretched his back.
"Where's she heading, man?"
demanded Redger.
"I can't say," said the finder. Her mind was very confused at this point.
"Can't say," sneered Redger. "It's what you're paid for, man."
Collarin knew just where she was, heading out through the open north gate, with half a mile to go before the safety of the tree line. He looked at Redger and smiled.
"Has she killed these men, Captain? She was thinking of you. She was wondering how she could reach you and draw a sharp knife across your testicles."
Redger winced.
"After that, she wandered away into that alley there. Perhaps she is still there, waiting."
"That leads to the north gate, sir," said one of the soldiers. "There is a stable there. We could get horses."
Redger nodded.
"Follow me,"
he ordered, and ran off. Collarin remained where he was, staring down at the dead Will Stamper. The thoughts of dying men were often strange, almost mundane sometimes. But this man had tried to speak on the point of death. Two words. Collarin shook his head.
"What a time to say, 'I'm sorry.'"
The more Fell considered his encounter with the old man, the more he believed it was a dream. That being so, he asked himself, "Why are you sitting here in the cold, waiting for dawn to rise over Citadel Town?" He smiled ruefully and poked the dying campfire with a long stick, trying to urge some life into the little blaze. Fell's sheepskin cloak was damp from the recent rain, and the fire had not the strength to warm him. It spluttered and spat, fizzled and sank low. He glanced at the sky. Dawn was still an hour away. He was sitting with his back against the shallow depression of a deep boulder, the fire set against a second tall stone. The forester looked down at the last of the wood he had gathered. It was also damp. To his left, Fell could see the twinkling lights of the cinder wings. He hoped they would come no closer. Fell had no wish to be visited by the ghosts of painful memories. The cinders were clustered under an oak branch, twisting and moving, their golden wings of light fluttering in the dark. When he was a child, Fell had caught one of them and rushed it home to his parents. In the light of the cabin it had proved to be nothing more than a moth with wide, beautiful wings and a dark, hairy body. Lying dead in his hand, it had seemed so ordinary. Yet out in the woods, its wings glowing with bright lights, it had been magical beyond imagining.
"You are a lucky boy," his father told him. "You're too young to have bad memories. Trust me, as you grow older, you will avoid the cinders."
How true it was. When Fell was 16, he had been walking through the night, following the trail of a lame wolf. He saw the flickering of cinderwing lights and walked in close to see them fly. Instantly, the vision of Matic's soon-to-be-drowned face filled his mind, the child reaching out to Fel as the undertow dragged him towards the rapids. Fel couldn't swim, and could only watch helplessly as the child was swept over the rocks, the white water thrashing around him. The face hovered in Fell's mind, and he dropped to his knees, tears coursing his cheeks.
"It was not my fault," he cried aloud, then scrambled back from the glowing insects.
After that, he gave the cinderwings a distant respect. The rain began again, and the cinders vanished from sight. Fel shook his head.
"A great fool ye are,"
he said aloud, watching the drops of rain settling on the longbow. The bow string was safe and dry in his belt pouch, his quiver of 12 shafts behind him and under his cloak, but Fel did not like to see his favourite hunting bow at the mercy of the weather. It was a fine bow, made by Kerith the Wingeran. Horn-tipped, it had a pull of more than 90 pounds. Fel, though not the finest of the loader bowmen, had not missed a killing shot since purchasing the weapon. An arrow would sing from the string, streaking to its target and sinking deep through skin, flesh, and muscle. It was important for a deer to die fast. Ideally, the beast would be dead before it knew it. Therefore, the meat remained tender and succulent. Whereas, if the creature was frightened, its muscles would tense and harden, and the meat would stay that way. Fel's bow supplied choice meat.
"What are you doing here, Fel? Following a dream you don't believe in," he said aloud.
The words of the dream man came back to him.
"In 3 days, outside the walls of Citadel Town, a sword will be raised, and the red will be worn again. Be there, Fel. In 3 days, at dawn, by the light of the new sun, you will see the birth of a legend."
The rain eased once more, and as the moon showed through the break in the clouds, the cinders glinted back into life. Fel hefted his bow and wiped the drops of water from its 6-foot length. Amazingly, the fire flared up, tongues of flame licking at the wood. Fel stretched out his hands and felt the welcome warmth.
"That is better," said Taliesin.
Fel's heart hammered, and he jumped like a startled squirrel. The old man had appeared from nowhere, seeming to blink into existence.
"It used to be,"
continued the druid, his cloak of feathers shining in the moonlight,
"that I enjoyed forest nights. But sometime during the last 100 years or so, my blood started to run thin." "Why can't you walk up to a fire like anyone else?"
stormed Fel.
"Because I'm not like everyone else. What point is there in possessing enormous talent if no one is given the opportunity to appreciate it? By heaven, boy, but you scare easily."
Taliesin rubbed a gnarled hand over his wood-smoked whiskers.
"No food this time, eh? Well, I suppose that is a blessing. You didn't touch it last time, so you have no way of knowing,"
said Fel.
"You're not real, old man. You're not flesh and blood."
As he spoke, Fel suddenly reached out and swept his hand across Taliesin's face. His fingers passed through the wrinkled skin, and he felt nothing but air against his palm.
"Good," said Taliesin. "You have intelligence. Yet you are still wrong. I am flesh and blood, but I am not flesh and blood here. I am sitting in my own cave in another place and another time. The energy needed to open the gateways for flesh is immense. There is no need to waste it when an astral projection will serve the same purpose. And since my role is merely to speak with you, my spirit image must suffice." "You breed words like lice," snapped Fel, still rattled, "and I don't relish having wizards at my fire. So speak your peace and be gone." "Tish, boy, where are your manners? Elders are to be treated with respect, surely even in this new and enlightened age. Did your parents teach you nothing? Your father, I recall, was a man of good breeding. "'For pity's sake, to see what you came to see,' said Fel. "'I am already sick of your lectures.'
Taliesin was silent for a moment.
"'Very well,' he said at last.
"'But mark the words well. Firstly, when I leave, I want you to string your bow. The time is drawing near when you will have to use it. Secondly, you know the location of the Alwyn Falls?'
"'Of course.' Where Iron Hand passed over, every loader child knows where it is.
When the arrows are loosed and blood is upon the ground, you must take the cloak wearer there. You understand?
Understand? No, I understand nothing. Firstly, I have no intention of loosing a shaft at anyone or anything, and secondly, who is the cloak wearer?
Have a little patience, Fel. And if you do not loose a shaft, a loved one of yours will die. Take me at my word, boy, and remember the pool. That is vital.
The old man vanished. The fire died instantly. Fel sent a whispered curse after the man, yet even as he spoke he drew the bowstring from his pouch and strung the bow. The first light of pre-dawn was heralded by birdsong, and Fel swung his quiver over his shoulder and walked to the top of the hill overlooking Citadel Town. There was nothing to see, save the grey walls and the rising stone of the keep beyond the town's rooftops. Gradually, the sky lightened, and he saw a tiny figure emerge from the north gate and begin to run towards the hills. Fel squinted, but could not at first identify the runner. Then, with a shock, he saw the dawn light glint on her silver hair. She was some 300 yards onto open ground when the three horsemen rode from the town. The lead rider was a soldier in helm and breastplate, as was the third, but it was the second man riding a grey stallion who caught Fel's attention. He was brandishing a sword, and he wore a red cloak. His excitement soared. Sigarni was running hard, but the horsemen were closing.
"Why do they have their swords drawn?" thought Fel.
And then it came to him in a sickening realization.
They are chasing her. They mean to kill her.
The lead horseman was a mere 50 yards behind her when Fel drew a shaft and notched it to the bowstring. It was not an easy shot. A fast-moving horseman, downhill from him, and with a light still poor. The enormity of what he was about to do filled Fell's mind, yet there was no hesitation. Smoothly he drew back the string until it nestled against his chin. Then he took a deep breath and slowly let it out. Between breaths and utterly motionless, he sighted carefully and loosed the shaft. The arrow sang through the air. For a fraction of a heartbeat, Fel thought he had missed. But the shaft slammed home in the lead rider's left eye, catapulting him from the saddle. Running forward, Fel notched a second arrow to the string. But he shot too swiftly, and the shaft flew past the red-cloaked officer and skimmed across the flank of the third man's horse. The beast reared, sending the soldier tumbling over its haunches in an ungainly somersault. The red-cloaked officer was almost upon the fleeing woman. Fel saw her glance back once, then turn and leap at the grey horse, waving her arms and shouting loudly. The grey swerved to avoid her, pitching its rider to the left. Sigarni leapt at the man, a silver blade glinting in her right fist. Her left hand caught hold of his cloak, dragging him from the saddle. The knife rose and fell. Blood gouted from a wound in the man's neck, and again, the knife flashed. Sigarni rose with the dead man's cloak in her hand. Fel watched as he gazed back at the citadel town. Scores of people were lining the parapets now. Sigarni swirled the crimson cloak around her shoulders, retying the snapped neck cord. Then she raised the dead man's sword and pointed it at the spectators. The sun finally rose, and Sigarni was bathed in its golden light, the iron sword shining like a torch of silver to match her hair. For Fel, it was as if time ceased to have meaning, and he knew that this scene would shine forever in his memory. The cloak wearer was Sigarni. She was the legend. Fel let out a long, slow breath. Sigani plunged the sword into the ground, then turned and slowly mounted the grey stallion. The third soldier was sitting on the ground nearby. Sigani ignored him and urged the horse on towards the trees, and the waiting fell. He saw the blood upon her shirt and leggings, the bruises and cuts on her face. But more than this, he saw the crimson cloak around her slender shoulders.
"What now for us all, Sigarni?"
he asked as she came closer.
"What now?"
Her eyes seemed unfocused, and she did not appear to hear him. Her face was losing its colour, the surface of the skin waxy and grey. The horse moved on, plodding into the trees. Fel ran after it, just in time to throw aside his bow and catch hold of Sigarni as she started to fall from the saddle. Pushing her foot clear of the stirrup, Fel levered himself to the stallion's back. With one arm holding the unconscious Sigarni to him, he took up the reins in his left hand and heeled the stallion forward. The old wizard had urged him to take her to the falls, but if he did so now, he would leave a clear trail behind him, the horse's hooves biting deeply into the damp earth. The pursuit was probably already underway, and with little time to plan, Fel urged the horse to greater speed and headed for the deeper forest. He rode for several miles, keeping to the deer trails, always climbing higher into the mountains. Glancing at the sky, he saw thick clouds to the north, dark and angry, their tops flattened like an anvil. Fel breathed a prayer of thanks, for such clouds promised hail and thunder and powerful storms. Hauling on the reins, he stepped down from the saddle, allowing Sigarni to fall into his arms and across his shoulder. The ground beneath his feet was rocky and firm, leaving no trace of his booted feet. He slapped the stallion firmly on the rump, and the horse leapt forward in a run, heading on down the slope towards the valley below. Fel left the trail, forcing his way through deep undergrowth. The ground broke sharply to his right into a muddy slope. It was hard to keep his footing here, especially with the added burden of Sigarni. He moved on carefully, occasionally slithering and sliding, keeping close to the trees that grew on the hillside, using them as barriers to halt any out-of-control slide. He was halfway down the slope when he heard the sound of horsemen on the road above. Dropping to his knees behind a screen of bushes, he looked back and saw the soldiers galloping by. There were more than 30 in the group. With a grunt, Fel pushed himself to his feet and struggled on. By his own reckoning, he was around 4 miles due east from the Alwyn Falls, but that 4 miles would become at least 6 by the route he would be forced to travel, along winding trails, skirting the steeper slopes and the many acres of open grassland. He was sweating heavily by the end of the first mile, and by the second, he felt his legs trembling with the effort of carrying the unconscious woman. Sigarni had made no sound throughout, and Fel paused by a stream, lowering her to the ground. Her colour was not good, and her pulse was faint and erratic. Carefully, he examined her, opening her torn shirt. There were bloody teeth marks on her breast, and a range of purple bruises on her ribcage and shoulders, but no deep wounds. "She's in shock," he thought. "It is vital to keep her warm, to find somewhere he could nurse her." Gently he stroked her bruised face. "You are safe, my love," he said softly. "Hold on for me." She did not stir as Fel wrapped the crimson cloak around her, then lifted her to his shoulders. Almost 2 hours had passed already since the fight above the town, and there were still 4 miles to go. Fel took a deep breath and struggled on, trying not to think of his aching muscles, the burning in his calves and thighs. For 3 more painful hours Fel carried Sigarni through the forest. In all that time, she made no sound. At last they arrived at the Alwyn Falls. There was no sign of the wizard. In a shallow cave, a little way back from the pool, Fel built a fire. Removing his own sheepskin cloak, he covered Sigarni with it, and holding her hand, talked to her as she slept. "Well," he said, squeezing her limp fingers, "this is a sorry mess and no mistake. We're wolves' heads now, my love. I wish I knew why. Why were they chasing you?
Who wounded you? Ah, well, I expect you'll tell me in your own good time. Shame about the bow, though. Best I ever had. But I couldn't carry it, hold you, and guide the horse at the same time.
Leaning forward, he stroked her brow.
You are the most beautiful woman, Sigourney. I never saw the like. Was that what caused your pain? Did some outland noble desire you so badly he felt compelled to take you by force? Was it the red-bearded man whose throat you slashed to red ribbons?
Releasing her hand, he fed wood to the fire and rose, walking to the cave mouth.
What now? He wondered. Where will we go?
He had relatives among the Wingerus and the Farlan, but with a price on his head he would only endanger them by seeking their aid.
No, Fel, he told himself. You are a man alone now, friendless and hunted. You have killed an outlander and they will hunt you to your dying day.
A roll of thunder boomed across the sky, and lightning forked across the heavens. Fel shivered and watched as the rain hammered down on the surface of the pool, falling in sheets thick and impenetrable. Stepping back from the cave mouth, he returned to the fire and the sleeping Sigourney.
"We will cross the sea, my love," he said, "and I'll do what I should have done. We'll marry and build a home in distant mountains." "No, you won't," said Taliesin from the cave mouth.
Fel smiled and swung to see the old man, his feather cloak dripping water, his wispy hair plastered to his skull. In his hands he carried a long staff wrapped in sacking cloth.
"That's a more pleasing entrance," said the forester. "Now I believe you're flesh and blood."
Taliesin removed his cloak and draped it over a rock. Squatting by the fire, he held out his ancient hands to the flames.
"You did well, boy," he said. "You have evaded the first hunters, but they will send more canny men, skilled in tracking, and with them will be a finder, a seeker of souls, a reader of thoughts. If you survive this, which is doubtful at best, they will send the night stalkers, creatures from the pit."
"No, no," said Fel. "Seek not to cheer me, old man, with your boundless optimism. I am a grown man. Tell it to me straight."
Taliesin hawked and spat.
"I've no time for your humour. We must protect her, Fel. Her importance cannot be overstated. You must go from here to her cabin, gather her weapons and some spare clothes, give them to the dwarf. Tell him and the others there what has occurred. Then you must find the hunters and lead them deep into the mountains."
Fel took a deep breath, fighting for calm. It didn't work.
"Find the hunters? Lead them? What say you, I just attack the citadel town single-handed and raise it to the ground? Or perhaps I could borrow your feather cloak and fly south, invading the outland cities and slaying the king? Are you insane, old man? What do you expect me to do against 30 soldiers?"
"Whatever you can."
The old man looked into Fel's eyes, his expression as cold as ice on flint.
"You are dispensable, Fel," said Taliesin. "Your death will matter only to you. You can be replaced. Everything can be replaced, save Sigourney. You understand? You must earn her time. Time to recover, time to learn. She is the leader your people have yearned for. Only she has the power to win freedom for the clans."
"They'll never follow a woman. That much I know."
Taliesin shook his head.
"They followed the Witch Queen 400 years ago. They crossed the gateways and died for her. They stood firm against the enemy, though they were outnumbered and faced slaughter. They will follow her, Fel."
"The Witch Queen was a sorceress. Sigourney is merely a woman."
"How blind you are,"
said the old man,
"and rich indeed in your male conceit. This woman was dragged to a cell and raped, sodomized, and beaten senseless by 4 men. Like animals they fell upon her."
"I don't want to hear this," roared Fel, half rising.
"But you shall,"
stormed the wizard.
"They struck her with their fists, and they bit her. They cut her buttocks with their sharp knives and forced her to unspeakable acts.
and they left her upon the floor of the cell to lie on the cold stone floor in a pool of her own vomit and blood. Aye, well might you look shocked, for this was men at play, Fell. She lay there, and after an hour or so a new guard came into the cell. He too wanted his piece of her flesh. She killed him, Fell. Then she hunted down the others. One she slew upon the dungeon stair, two she killed outside a tavern, and the last? You saw him, in his fine red cloak of wool. Him she tore the throat from. Just a woman, by all the gods of the Nine Worlds, boy! In her tortured condition, she killed 6 strong men.
Fell said nothing, and transferred his gaze to the sleeping woman.
Aye, she's a Highlander,
he said with pride.
But even that will not make men follow her. We will see, said Taliesin. Now go to her cabin before the hunters reach it. Send the dwarf with weapons and clothes. You will stay with her. Indeed I will.
Fell rose and swung his quiver over his shoulder, then gazed down at the unconscious Sigourney.
I will keep her warm, said Taliesin. Oh, and I retrieved your bow.
Lifting what Fell had believed to be a staff covered in sacking, Taliesin passed the weapon to the surprised forester.
He even kept it dry. My thanks to you, wizard. I feel a whole man again.
Taliesin ignored him and turned to the sleeping Sigourney, taking her long, slim hand into his own. Swirling his cloak around his shoulders, Fell stepped out into the rain-drenched night. Sigourney stood silently by the grey cave wall and listened as Fell and the old man spoke. She could hear their words, see their faces, and even, though she knew not how, feel their emotions. Fell was frightened, and yet trying to maintain an air of male confidence. The old man, Taliesin, was tired, yet filled with a barely suppressed excitement, and lying by the fire looking so sad and used, she could see herself, wrapped in the rapist's red cloak, her face bruised and swollen. I am dying, she thought. My spirit has left my body, and now only the void awaits. There was no panic in her, no fear, only a sadness built of dreams never to be realized. Fell took his bow from the old man and walked from the cave. Sigourney tried to call out to him, but he did not hear her. No one could hear her, save maybe the dead. But she was wrong. As soon as Fell walked out into the rain, the old man looked up at her, his button-bright eyes focusing on her face.
Well, now we can talk, he said. How are you feeling?
Sigourney was both surprised and confused. The old man was holding the hand of her body, yet looking directly into the eyes of her spirit. It was disconcerting. I feel nothing, she said. Is this what death is like? He gave a dry chuckle, like the whispering of the wind across dead leaves.
You're talking to a man who has fought back death for many centuries. I do not even wish to speculate on what death is like. Do you remember the waking of your spirit?
Yes. Someone called me. But when I opened my eyes, he was not here. How is this happening, old one?
I fear the answer may be too complicated for an untutored Highlander to understand. Essentially, your body has been so brutalized that your mind reeled from thoughts of it. You have entered a dream state which has freed your soul, if you will. Now you feel no pain, no shame, no guilt. And while we talk, your body is healing. I have, through my skill, increased the speed of the process. Even so, when you do return to the prison of flesh, you will feel, shall we say, considerable discomfort?
Do I know you? Asked Sigourney.
Do you think that you do?
He countered. I can remember being held close to your chest, You have a small mole under the chin. I know this. And in looking at you, I can see another man. Enormously tall, broad-shouldered, wearing a buckskin shirt with a red wingspread hawk silhouette upon the breast.
Taliesin nodded. Childhood memories. Yes, you knew me, child. The other man was Kaz Wallen. One day, if God is kind, you will meet him again.
You both saved me from the demons. Out there, by the pool. Gwalchmai told me. Who are you, Taliesin? Why have you helped me?
I am merely a man. A great man, mind. My reasons for helping you are utterly selfish. But now is not the time to speak of things past. The days of magic and power are upon us, Sigourney. The days of blood and death are coming.
I want no part in them, she said.
You have little chance in the matter, and you will feel differently when you wake. In spirit form, you are free of much more than merely the flesh. The human body has many weapons. Rage, which increases muscle power. Fear, which can hone the mind wonderfully. Love, which binds with ties of iron. And hate, which can move mountains. There are many more, but in astral form, you are connected only tenuously to these emotions. It was rage and the need for revenge which saved your life, which drove you on to wear the red. That rage is still there, Sigourney, a fire that needs no kindling, an eternal blaze that will light the road to greatness. But it rests in the flesh, awaiting your return.
You were correct, old one. I do not understand all you see. How do I return to my flesh?
Not yet. First, go from the cave. Walk to the pool.
She shook her head. There is a ghost there.
Yes,
he said.
Call him.
Sigourney was on the point of refusing when Taliesin lifted his hand and pointed to the fire. The flames leapt up to form a sheer bright wall some 4 feet high. Then at the centre, a small spot of colourless light appeared, opening to become a pale, glistening circle. It glowed snow-white, then gently became the blue of a summer sky. Sigourney watched spellbound as the blue faded, and she found herself staring through the now transparent circle into her own cabin. She was there, talking with Gwalchmai. The conversation whispered into her mind.
"Who was the ghost?" asked the image of Sigourney.
"Go and ask him, woman. Call for him."
She shivered and looked away.
"I can't."
Gwalch chuckled.
"There is nothing you cannot do, Sigourney. Nothing."
"Oh, come on, Gwalch. Are we not friends? Why won't you help me?"
"I am helping you. I'm giving you good advice. You don't remember the night of the slaughter. You will, when the time is right. I helped take the memory from you when I found you by the pool. Madness had come upon you, girl. You were sitting in a puddle of your own urine. Your eyes were blank and you were slack-jawed. I had a friend with me. His name was Taliesin. It was he, and another who slew the slaughterers. Taliesin told me we were going to lock away the memory and bring you back to the world of the living. We did exactly that. The door will open one day, when you're strong enough to turn the key. That's what he told me."
Now the circle shrank to a dot, and the flames of the fire returned to normal.
"Am I strong enough to turn the key?" she asked Taliesin.
"Go to the pool and find out,"
he advised.
"Call for him."
Sigourney stood silently for a moment, then moved past the old man and out into the night. The rain was still hammering down, but she could not feel it, nor strangely could she hear it. Water tumbled over the falls in spectacular silence. Ferocious winds tore silently at the trees and their leaf-laden branches. Lightning flared in the sky, but the voice of the accompanying thunder could not be heard. The huntress moved to the poolside.
"I am here,"
she called. There was no answer. No stirring upon the water, merely silence.
"Call to him by name,"
came the voice of Taliesin in her mind. And she knew, and in knowing wondered how such an obvious realization should have escaped her so long.
"Iron Hand," she called. "It is I, Sigourney. Iron Hand."
The waters bubbled and rose like a fountain, the spray forming an arched gateway, lit by an eldritch light. A giant man appeared in the gateway, his silver beard in twin braids, his hair tied back at the nape of his neck. He wore silver bright armor and carried a long leaf-bladed broadsword that glistened as if it had been carved from moonlight. He raised the sword in greeting, and then sheathed it at his side and spoke, his voice rich and resonant.
"Come to me, Sigourney,"
he said.
"Walk with me a while."
"You spoke to me in Citadel Town," she said. "You urged me to flee."
"Yes."
"And you fought for me when I was a child. You slew the last Hollow Tooth."
"That also."
"Why?"
"For love, Sigourney. For love that will not accept death. Will you walk with me a while?"
"I will,"
she said, tears brimming. And she stepped forward to walk upon the water. Chapter 6. Despite the excruciating pain flaring from the empty eye socket, the Baron Ranulf Gotterson enjoyed the awestruck and fearful expressions of the men before him. Idly the fingers of his left hand stroked the carved dragon claws on the arm of the ornate chair. Sharp they were, as they gripped the globe of ebony. The men waited silently below the dais. He knew their thoughts, and more importantly, their growing anxiety. They had failed. The woman who had robbed him of his eye was still at large. The Baron leaned back on the high-carved chair and stared balefully down at the 20 men before him, his single eye bloodshot, but its gaze piercing. "So," he said softly, his voice sibilant and chilling,
"tell me that you have captured the woman and the renegade?"
The officer before him, a tall man sporting a square-cut beard but no moustache, cleared his throat. His chainmail leggings were mud-smeared, and his right arm was clumsily bandaged.
We have not caught them yet, my lord. I brought the men back for fresh supplies.
You did not catch them?
Repeated the Baron, rising from his chair.
One woman and a forester? Riding double on a stolen stallion? But you did not catch them.
Slowly he descended the three steps from the dais and halted before the officer. The man dropped his head and mumbled something.
Speak up, child. Let us all hear you.
The officer reddened, but he raised his head and his voice boomed out.
They fooled us. They turned the stallion loose and cut across the valleys. Then the storm came and it was impossible to read sign. But we followed as best we could, thinking the woman would return to her people. The renegade forester fell, shot at us from ambush, wounding two of my men. We gave chase, my lord, but heavily armed riders are useless in the thickets. We left our horses and tried to follow on foot. It was like trying to catch a ghost. I had no archers with me. Three more men were struck by his arrows. Happily, their armor saved them from serious injury, though the mercenary Lava still has an arrow head lodged in his shoulder.
Chard fell silent. The Baron nodded solemnly.
So, what you are saying is that 30 outland warriors are no match for a woman and a clansman?
No, my lord, I am saying, be silent, fool!
Did you think at any time during the 4 days you have been gone to send back to Citadel for trackers?
Did you not consider hiring the services of the finder Kolarin? Did you set the renegade's own people to hunt him?
His own people?
The Baron half turned away, then swung back his fist, smashing the officer's lips against his teeth. The skin split and blood sprayed out as Chard was hurled backwards. He fell heavily, cracking his skull against the base of a statue. Chard gave out one grunting moan, then slid into unconsciousness.
"You have all failed me," said the Baron. "But his was the greater sin. He will suffer for it. Now, you,"
he said, pointing to a burly soldier with close-cropped fair hair.
"You are Aubryn the Southlander, yes?"
"Yes, my lord."
The man bowed.
"You have fought barbarians before, I understand, in Kushir, Palol, Umbria, and Cleersha."
"Yes, my lord, and served also in Pesht under your command. I was there when you stormed the wall, sir, though I was but a common soldier then."
"And now you are a sergeant-at-arms. Answer me well, and you shall assume command of the hunt and become a captain. Tell us all now what arrows were made by the idiot lying at your feet."
Aubryn drew a breath and was silent for a moment. The Baron smiled. He knew what was going through the man's mind. No enlisted soldier wished to be made an officer. The pay would not cover the mess bills, and from its meagre supply he would have to purchase his own horse and armour and hire a manservant. Oberyn's round face paled. Then he spoke.
"The trail was cold from the moment the storm broke, my lord. We should have headed for Kilfallon and taken hostages. Then the foresters themselves could have hunted down their comrade. I would also have posted a reward for their capture just in case. There's not much coin in the Highlands, and there's always some bastard who'd sell his mother for a copper or two, if you take my meaning, my lord."
Aubryn paused and rubbed his broad chin.
"You have already mentioned the finder Kolarin, but I'll be honest with you, my lord. I would not have thought of him, sir. And if it please you, I don't want Captain Chard's command. I'm no nobleman, and I wouldn't fit in. I don't have the brains for it. But I am a good sergeant, sir."
The Baron ignored the soldier and climbed to the dais to return to his seat. His eye socket was throbbing and tongues of fire were lancing up into his skull. Yet he kept his expression even and showed no trace of the pain he was feeling.
"Find Kolarin and take him with you when you have your supplies. Take 50 men, split them into two sections. One will ride to Kilfallon and post a reward of 100 guineas. This group will also take 4 hostages and return them to Citadel. The second group, led by you, Aubryn, will include Kolarin. You will start your search at the woman's cabin, and before you leave, you will take the former Captain Chard to the whipping post, where you will apply 50 lashes to his naked back. With every lash, I want you to consider this. Fail, and one of your men will be lashing you."
"Yes, sir,"
said Aubryn, miserably. The Baron waved his hand, dismissing the men.
"Not you, Leofric," he said, as the slender blonde-haired cleric was about to leave. "Shut the door and come to me in my study."
Leaving the dais, the Baron strode across the hall and through a small side door, leading to a flight of steps that took him up to the parapet study. A goblet had been placed on the desk filled with dark, noxious liquid. The Baron hated medicines of any kind, and pain-masking opiates in particular. But the injury was now interfering with his thought processes, and he drained the foul brew and sat with his back to the open window. Leofric knocked twice, then entered the study.
"I am sorry, cousin, for your pain and your disappointment," he said uneasily. "The pain is nothing, but I am not disappointed, boy,"
the Baron told him, motioning the younger man to a seat opposite him.
"Far from it. The Highlands need to be purged, and the excuse has now fluttered in on the wings of a dead hawk. A woman rebel was arrested after attacking the king's emissary. Highlanders raided the dungeons to release her. Then they attacked the king's soldiers. When word reaches the south, the king will send another 5,000 men to serve under me, and we will march from Citadel to the sea and wipe out the clans once and for all."
"I don't understand,"
said Leofric.
How are the clans a danger to the Empire? They have no military organization indeed, no army, and there is no insurrection.
The Baron smiled.
Then we cannot lose, can we, Leofric? And at the end I will have an army as large as Yastai's. The king grows old and soft. You think Yastai has no plans to seize the crown for himself? Of course he has. And I can do nothing to stop him while I am stuck away here in this godforsaken wilderness. However, a war against the clans, well, that has great merit. In the south they still fear these northerners, and old men recall with dread how the shrieking savages erupted from the mountains, bringing fire and death to the lowlands. You will see, Leofric. As soon as news reaches the south of this latest outrage, the price of land south of the border will plummet. The weak-hearted will sell up and move, and panic will sweep through the immediate lowland towns.
That I do understand, said Leofric. But what if the Highlanders do hunt down this Fell and the woman? What if they surrender them to us to save the hostages?
The Baron shook his head.
It won't happen. I know these barbarians. They are all too proud. I'll hang the hostages as soon as they reach Citadel and leave the bodies on the north wall for all to see. And if that doesn't force at least a show of resistance, I'll burn Kilfallen and a few of their towns.
And what task would you have me perform, my lord?
Asked Leofric.
There will be no major invasion of the Highlands until spring. We want time for the fear to grow back home. I intend to attack with 6,000 fighting men and 500 engineers. You must put your mind to the questions of how we feed and supply this army all the way to the sea. Also, I want you to study the maps and locate 3 sites for our fixed camps and fortifications. You know what is required? The fort should be situated close to the lands of the Pallades and the Farlan. Choose open ground, yet close enough to the woods for the men to be able to gather timber for the walls.
Questions?
Yes, my lord. The fortifications. I am well aware of the standard design used for the construction of temporary fortifications during punitive raids in hostile territory, but these are rough constructions not intended for more than a few nights. Will they suffice?
The Baron considered the question.
The Highland winters were notoriously savage, and the forts would need to be manned throughout the long, bitter months, until the invasion. More important than this, however, was the likelihood of Highlanders attacking the outposts. There would be no way to reinforce them once the snow blocked the passes.
You misunderstood my use of the word standard, said the Baron smoothly. This is not a punitive raid, but should be considered as a full invasion. The forts, therefore, will have regulation defences, earth barriers at least 10 feet high, topped with timber walls to another 15 feet. Weighted portcullis gates will also be constructed. You are familiar with the design?
Of course, my lord. It was devised by Driada during the Cletian Wars in the last century, but was possibly based on an earlier...
I did not ask for a history lesson, Leofric. You will take 200 engineers and 300 infantrymen into the Highlands. Then you will oversee the building of these forts, and within them storehouses for supplies. Make sure the storehouses are watertight. I want no rotting meat, no mildewed cereal when I arrive with the army.
Leofric stood and bowed.
I thank you for your trust in me, cousin. I will not fail you.
Sigarni opened her eyes and saw the flickering flame shadows on the cave ceiling. She watched them for a moment, then felt the onrush of pain from her wounded body. A voice spoke from her left.
She is awake. Pour some broth for her.
Sigarni rolled her head towards the sound, focusing her eyes upon a wizened old man with deep-set pale eyes.
Taliesin, she whispered.
"Aye, lass, Taliesin. How are you feeling?"
"Hurt. What happened to me?"
You don't remember the attack in Citadel Dungeons?
She closed her eyes. Of course I do. But that was years ago. I meant, why am I injured now?
Taliesin leaned forward and helped her to sit up. Pain lanced through Sigani's right side and she groaned.
One of your ribs is cracked. It will heal soon,
said Taliesin. Another figure moved into sight. Child small yet bearded. Sitting at her right, Ballistar handed her a wooden bowl and spoon. The broth was thick and salty, and Sigani became acutely aware of her hunger. She ate in silence. When she had finished, Ballistar took back the bowl. Sigani felt her strength returning, but still she was confused.
Why did you mention the attack on me? She asked Taliesin.
Because it happened 3 days ago, he said slowly. You have been spirit wandering in a place where there is no time.
I remember, she said. He took me by the hand.
Who took her?
Asked Ballistar. Taliesin waved him to silence.
Yes, you walked with him,
said the wizard, taking Sigani's hand. She wrenched it back, her eyes blazing.
Do not touch me! No man will ever touch me again!
The violence in her voice was startling, surprising Ballistar, who dropped the empty bowl. It rolled across the cave floor, coming to rest against the far wall. Taliesin seemed unmoved by the rebuff.
I'm sorry, my dear. That was remiss of me. Did you learn much in your time with him?
It is easy now, she said sleepily. But he said he would teach me. Would always be with me.
Sigani stretched out again and closed her eyes. Taliesin covered her with a blanket of wool.
What was she talking about? Asked Ballistar. When did she go walking? And who was?
Taliesin rose and walked to the fire.
Time to gather more wood, he said. Who did she walk with?
Repeated Ballistar.
It is not for you to know, dwarf. Now go and fetch some wood. The black man will be here soon, and then you'll understand a little more of what is happening here.
I'm not your servant, snapped Ballistar. I do not have to jump through hoops because you say so.
No, agreed Taliesin. You don't. But I am trying to keep her warm, and I'm a little too old to relish walking around a forest and stooping to collect dead wood. You, on the other hand, do not have far to stoop. I'll do it for her, said the dwarf. But know this, Taliesin, I do not like you. Not one bit. How wise of you,
Taliesin told him. Ballistar stomped from the cave and out into the afternoon sunlight. Fallen wood was plentiful, following the storm, and he spent an idle hour gathering armfuls of fuel and carrying them back to the cave. Taliesin spent the hour sitting silently beside the sleeping Sigani. Bored now, Ballistar returned to the poolside and stared out over the water. It was smooth and motionless here, and the reflections of the trees on the opposite shore could be seen growing upside down in the pool. Ballistar moved to the edge and knelt, leaning out over the water. His own face looked back at him, the deep-set brown eyes gazing into his.
"What is it like in an upside-down world?"
he asked his reflection.
"Are you happy or sad?"
The face in the pool mouthed the same words back to him. Ballistar moved back and sat with his back to the trunk of a weeping willow. Asmodeer came riding down the slope, and Ballistar stood. The black man was wearing clothes of brown and russet with a deep green cloak. He sported no burnous, and upon his head he wore a helm of burnished iron that rose to a glistening silver point at the crown. Seeing Ballistar, he drew rein and stepped from the saddle.
"Where is she?"
he asked. Ballistar pointed to the cave.
"There's a wizard with her. Unpleasant little man."
"How is she?"
"Beaten and abused,"
She will get better, though. I know it.
The black man nodded.
I know it